Every business has an ambition. PayPal Open is the platform designed to help you grow into yours. With business loans so you can expand and access to hundreds of millions of PayPal customers worldwide. And your customers can pay all the ways they want. With PayPal, Venmo, Pay Later, and all major cards. So you can focus on scaling up. When it's time to get growing, there's one platform for all business. PayPal Open. Grow today at paypalopen.com. Loans subject to approval in available locations.
Setlist in association with 7 Digital.
This week, music business numbers, the week in stats. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
As ever, we are going to take a look back at some of the biggest and most interesting music industry news stories of the last week. A week when the Hypnosis Songs Fund took a break from buying up individual songwriter rights and instead bought up a whole publishing company.
And that was a big deal.
Yes. And it was also big deal, that being the publishing company that it bought.
It was a big deal involving big deal, which most people think was a really big deal.
Yes.
Which is nice, isn't it?
Yeah.
So yeah, the Hypnosis Songs Fund has become a very regular guest in the CMU Daily Bulletin. We seem to be reporting on them several times a week because they keep buying stuff.
Yeah, they've been buying all sorts of catalogues and portions of catalogues of, as I said, individual songwriters and performers and producers, basically hoovering up lots of different bits of either copyrights or the portions of royalties of certain artists. And as I said, it's called the Hypnosis Songs Fund because it's not just a normal publishing company, it's a financial company. They basically get people to invest in song rights. And Hypnosis and its founder, Merck Mercuriadis, argue that song rights as an investment are more predictable than gold.
And you can choose to believe that or not. But what we do know is quite a lot of rich people, city people, institutions have believed it, pumped a whole load of money into this fund, and then basically what Merck and his team have been doing, as you say, is buying up all of these copyrights, or sometimes the writer's share or the performer's share of revenue generated by copyrights. Each deal has been a little bit different, but the catalogue of rights have just been growing and growing and growing, and we keep reporting on all of these deals. Now that these rights are building, obviously what this fund needs to do, because although the company is very keen to stress that it's very supportive of the artists and songwriters that it's now working with, and the artists and songwriters who've done the deal have banked the checks, but also been very keen to put out statements saying how excited they are about this new approach to doing music. But ultimately, what this company now needs to do is to manage and administrate all of these rights in an as effective a way as possible so that money comes in, so that the investors can get a return on their investment. And there have been a few deals behind the scenes to help the fund manage their rights. But what has happened this week is that Hypnosis has actually bought a company, that being, as we say, Big Deal Music Publishing, an American publishing company that has operations across America and indeed here in the UK. And in that deal, two things happen. First of all, it gets yet more catalogue, because Big Deal had a catalogue of rights. But perhaps more importantly than that, it brings infrastructure and a team to the business. So Big Deal will now rebrand as the Hypnosis Songs Group. And we assume, I mean, they didn't go into all of this detail in the announcement, but we assume that this company will now be working closely with the team that had already been put in place, mainly here in the UK, to basically run this catalogue and to get the most out of this catalogue. But it is interesting because, I mean, as you said, the Hypnosis Songs Fund to date, although it's been buying up all of these music rights, hasn't been a traditional music company, and it's been quite keen to present itself as not being just another music publishing company. It has also bought up some recording rights, not just another record label or catalogue label. It's something quite different. Big Deal, meanwhile, it's more of a traditional music publisher. But obviously, if you want to get the most out of the rights that you've acquired, you need some of the traditional music industry within your business. You need to be members of the collecting societies. You need to have databases and systems in place to administrate the rights. You need to have relationships with other publishers around the world so that you have global reach. You need all of those things, the things that a traditional music company has. So that's what Hypnosis gets through this deal. But what will be interesting to see now is how it evolves moving forward. Because the whole point about Hignosis is we're different. We're not a publishing company. We're a songs company, is one thing they've been saying. We're here to manage songs in the same way that you might manage an artist. This is all part of the narrative around the business. So it'll be interesting to see how all of this gets meshed together and to what extent at the end of it we have a music rights company that looks totally different to everything that's gone before, or to what extent by acquiring a traditional, I mean, okay, yes, a relatively young, smaller, independent publisher, but by acquiring a more traditional music publishing company, how much of the traditional infrastructure will end up in the business. So there you go. That's what's happened this week in the world of Hignosis, but that, and we should stress this, is not what we're here to talk about this week.
No, this week, in a deviation from our usual format, because sticking to formats is for losers, we are going to look at five news stories through five stats.
Yeah, so a slightly different way of looking back at the last week in music and the music business on Setlist this week, partly because a couple of weeks ago, Andy Malt insisted that we would never deviate from the classic Setlist format. So it seems like once Andy said that, we have to deviate from the classic Setlist format. Otherwise, Andy might have been honest and have some integrity. So that's...
I'm just taking my cues from the UK government.
So that's one reason for doing this. Also, maybe there wasn't a big enough news story in the last week of the music industry which really justifies the full Setlist treatment. So we've come up with a new way...
Some people might say that.
...of dipping into some smaller stories without having to spend quite so much time talking about them because they don't justify it. Maybe that's the reason we're doing it, I don't know. But yes, so who knows how this is going to work, but we've picked five stats, five numbers, five figures that have been doing the rounds in the last 7 days within the music business news, and we're going to talk about each of them and the story around them.
So first off, here is stat number one. US recorded music revenues were up 5.6% year on year for the first half of 2020, despite this whole pandemic thing we've got going on. American record labels brought in $5.65 billion over the first 6 months of the year, according to RIAA figures, aided in the fact that the bulk of that money is now coming from premium streaming rather than more COVID volatile areas of the industry.
Yes, so these are half-year figures coming in from the Recording Industry Association of America. Which of those two stats that you've just done are you saying is the first stat? The 5.6% year-on-year growth, not the $5.65 billion in revenue.
No, all other stats are substats.
Okay.
5.6% is the stat.
Whichever is the first stat you... I'm just getting the format sorted in my head.
Yeah.
Whichever is the first stat you say is the stat, and any other numbers that we then say in relation to it, that's not one of this week's top five stats of the week.
No, they are supplementary stats.
Because we wouldn't want people getting confused. So, yeah,
no, because there's more than five stats in this story. So.
So, yes, latest revenue figures from the US record industry. And obviously, these days, trade bodies for the record industry around the world, particularly in the big mature markets like the US, UK, Germany, etc., are always putting out reports about how the industry is doing. And because in more recent years, generally speaking, the record industry in most countries has been in growth, they like putting out these stats and talking about how well things are going. Sometimes we talk about them on Setlist, sometimes we don't, because in essence, even if some figures can be talked about, the trend is the same. But I guess the reason why these figures are interesting and worth talking about is because of the COVID pandemic, as you alluded to. And I remember back in the early days of the pandemic, 47 years ago, it seems like, not that edition of Setlist, which I recorded in your house, which was the first time we talked about the coronavirus on the podcast. And we talked about...
We were in the same place. That's how long ago it was.
We were face to face and we were talking about, oh, there's this coronavirus thing and it's causing some events to be cancelled in America. I wonder if we'll talk about it again on the podcast, we said. But a couple of weeks after that, once shutdown had begun and our lives had been changed forever, and we were saying, okay, the live industry by that point, you know, had closed down in most markets completely. And we were talking about, okay, well, what will be the impact of this? And obviously at that point, we didn't know if we were talking about a 1 month thing or a 6 week thing, or as it turns out, at least a 6 month thing. But I remember one thing that we did talk about on that edition of Setlist was how while the live industry was now in shutdown, and that was catastrophic for the live industry and for all the people and companies who work on the live side of the music industry, and for artists for whom live was a key, maybe the key revenue stream, this was going to be a major, major, major challenge. We then said, but what about the music rights industry, the copyright side of the industry, and particularly the record industry? And we talked about how, had this happened in the physical era, in the CD era, it would have been a significant challenge for the record industry as well as the live industry. Possibly not as big a challenge, but still, in an era when making money out of recorded music required people to be able to go into physical buildings on the high street and buy plastic discs, and you had to be able to do all of the promo and marketing around launching those discs, it would have had a major impact. Whereas, because in the streaming age, the biggest revenue stream in most markets now for recorded music is subscription streaming, where people set up a direct debit and they hand over whatever it is, £10, $10, €10, or whatever, every single month. And in a way, providing people don't cancel those direct debits, providing that money keeps coming in, it doesn't really matter whether, because of COVID, they're listening to less music. Because there was some stats early on, wasn't there, in shutdown, saying how, because people weren't commuting, people on average were listening to less music than they normally would.
Yeah, they were at home watching video streaming services instead.
But the point is, providing they don't stop listening to music to such an extent that they think, do you know what, I don't need a Spotify subscription anymore, it doesn't really matter if people are listening to less music. And although plenty of labels and artists have continued to release and market new material during shutdown, again, to an extent, if the release schedule goes down, if we're putting out less new music, whereas in the CD era, that would have been a massive problem, in the digital era, it doesn't really matter. It just means people are going to listen to catalogue and we earn off that instead. So we were basically saying the record industry is not completely immune from COVID, because it has other revenue streams as well which are impacted by shutdown, but that what is now the main revenue stream, subscription streaming, probably wouldn't be affected. Actually, it had the potential to be beneficial, because maybe more people would be at home, more people would be playing around with their voice-activated devices and stuff like that, and maybe more people would actually sign up for subscription streaming. So that's what we said relatively early on in shutdown. And I guess the point is that these figures from the Recording Industry Association of America seem to suggest, in the US at least, what we predicted was correct.
Yeah, so the RIAA said that premium streaming revenues themselves were up 13.7% in the first half of the year and now account for 67% of total revenues. They also said that 72 million Americans are now signed up to a fully on-demand premium streaming service.
So crucially, throughout COVID shutdown, people have continued to pay to access premium streaming services. More people have signed up, so the number of subscribers is continuing to go up. So that key revenue stream, which, as you say, in the US, 67% of total revenues. So, you know, more than two-thirds of all revenues now are coming from those subscription streaming services, and they have not been affected by COVID. Physical product has, CD in particular, has been affected because people couldn't go out on the high street. Sync has been affected because the movie studios and the TV companies put a lot of their productions on hold. The free streaming services have been affected to an extent because the advertising industry had a big wobble at the start of shutdown. Although it has to be said that the impact of that on the free streaming services only slowed down the growth. It didn't put the ad income for the free streaming services down. It's continued to grow. It's just not grown as fast as maybe we would have hoped. But crucially, even though some of those other revenue streams have been affected by COVID, because now the biggest revenue stream is subscription streaming, it doesn't matter. Hence why, overall, we have that 5.6% year-on-year growth for the first half of 2020 for the American recorded music business. So, on the recorded side of the industry, still plenty of room for optimism, contrasting, of course, with the live side of the business, which is still really, really struggling, and so many questions remain as to when the live industry will begin the revival that everybody is hoping will come at some point.
And speaking of revivals, there was one other stat from these RIAA figures going around the music press last week, and that was that vinyl sales overtook CD sales for the first time since the 1980s over the first half of 2020. That is as a result of a 3.6% growth in vinyl sales over the full first half of the year, while CD sales slumped massively, went down 47.6%. Now, that's not showing that vinyl has been very robust during the pandemic. Actually, during lockdown, vinyl sales went down as well, but they had been very strong earlier in the year, which helped them stay in positive figures.
But yes, for those vinyl fans out there, the fact that vinyl is now outperforming CD in the US, as you say, for the first time since the 1980s, that's a big, bold moment. It is more because CD sales, I mean, obviously CD sales in America have been in pretty steep decline for quite some time now, but I mean, some real big decline happening during COVID lockdown, presumably because the people who are still buying CDs in America are probably buying them in, you know, the Best Buys and the supermarkets where they just weren't going so much because of all the lockdown stuff. So CD sales, even though they are always in a downwards trajectory these days, a significant slip in the first half of the year, which is, yeah, so now vinyl is outperforming CDs again, much to the joy of vinyl fans and all those journalists who like writing about the vinyl revival everywhere. So there you go. Yeah, that was stat number one with some accompanying stats that the US recorded music market saw revenue growth, retail revenue growth of 5.6% in the first half of 2020.
Stat number two, Boris Johnson's Operation Moonshot could cost as much as £100 billion. This is a plan put forward last week by the British Prime Minister to introduce a mass COVID-19 testing programme in order to get the UK economy up and running again while we wait for a vaccine. Among the things this would help with would be to allow live music events to run at full capacity again, although there are some issues with the plan, not least that hefty price tag.
Yeah, as has become customary here in the UK in recent years, and certainly during the COVID pandemic, whenever a statement is made by the government, and particularly by Prime Minister Boris Johnson, almost immediately a bunch of people pop up who all seem to have certain degrees of expertise, and they pick holes in the statement that has just been made by the PM or by one of the other ministers of the UK government. And there were various holes being pointed out in this brand plan of Johnson, not least the 100 billion price tag, and where the hell is that 100 billion pounds coming from? There was also the issue that this grand plan relies on some technology that hasn't been invented yet. Boris Johnson is always coming up with grand plans that rely on technology that hasn't been invented yet. So who knows whether any of the things that were being announced could come to fruition. But I mean, as you said, although this was a general COVID-19 announcement by the UK government, it was directly relevant to the live music industry, which, as we know, continues to suffer because of COVID-19. Although within the UK, in England, in theory, gigs can happen again, both indoors and outdoors. They can only happen with some really strict social distancing rules being in place, which most venues, most promoters say, once you apply those social distancing rules, we have to reduce the capacity to such an extent. We have to hire extra security and put up like Perspex screens and all of that, to the extent that we just can't make it work financially. It's not commercially viable. If we put on shows with those rules in place, we will lose money. So actually, although in theory shows can happen again, they can't, which is why this grand plan of the UK government, which is, well, what if we just got into the habit of testing everybody for the virus all the time? Not just people who think they have the virus, but everybody. So as you walk into work, or you walk into school or college, or you arrive at a show and a venue, somebody is there, they do a really speedy test. Within 20 minutes, the results are back from that test. Then you're allowed to go in the venue. And we know that everybody going in is virus-free, so we can pack that venue out like we normally would. This is the way that we are going to get the live industry and everything else back to pre-pandemic levels, even when there isn't a vaccine for COVID-19. So that's why this was directly relevant to the live industry. And I suppose, as is quite common with the UK government, this grand plan, this rather ambitious plan, was presented at the same time as the news that in some ways we've gone back here in the UK with regards to COVID, because some of the restrictions that had been lifted previously have been put back in place.
Yes, this actually was, I suppose, Boris Johnson trying to add a little bit of optimism to the main announcement, which was that in England now, you can only have six people around your house because COVID-19 infections have sharply risen in the UK. But the crucial point there is it's in your house. They're putting the focus on houses, even though I'm not sure houses are the key place where people catch COVID-19. But the main thing, and the thing that he stressed very firmly, was that this was not another lockdown. It's a tightening of measures, because what he really doesn't want to do, having opened it all up a bit, is to shut it all down again. So it's in your house, it's not at school, it's not in your place of work, and crucially for the live music industry, it is not in music venues, because obviously they've recently, as you said, made it that you can have indoor concerts again with these social distancing measures, and that is not affected by this.
No, if you want to be generous to the government, you could say, well, what they're saying is in workplaces and colleges and venues, there are now these social distancing rules. Those institutions and businesses go out of their way to ensure the social distancing rules are obeyed. So therefore, we don't need to have these new restrictions there. It's only when people are in domestic environments where those social distancing rules are not being enforced in the same way, that's where we need to have these tightening of restrictions. Although one person did say to me earlier this week, basically it's new lockdown measures for anywhere except where there's a till. as you alluded to, there is the ongoing concern about we've kind of got the economy moving again, and we don't want to stop that. But from a live music perspective, so on one level, yes, these restrictions don't hugely change what the current situation was for people who are running venues and putting on shows, except that the social distancing rules remain, which make those shows not commercially viable for many people. And I mean, even if it doesn't have a tangible impact on live music, given that in the last couple of weeks we've increasingly been having people in government talking about that they're increasingly optimistic that we're going to be able to relax the social distancing rules for venues, and therefore we could get more people into venues, higher capacity shows going this side of Christmas. That's been what people in government have been saying in recent weeks. The fact we've now seen this spike and these new restrictions kind of puts a dampener on all of that. Hence why I think Operation Moonshot was in there to sort of be saying, oh, but the general move in the right direction, that's definitely not going to stop. We're going to have all of this sorted very soon. Basically, as soon as Boris Johnson has found £100 billion lying around in a cupboard and some technology that doesn't exist yet. But as soon as we've got that money and that technology, it'll all be sorted.
Yes, but I suppose, I mean, it is the latest in a long line of bold claims about what the government thinks it can do in the face of COVID-19, most of which have turned out not to be true. I mean, in the week leading up to that announcement, the UK found itself struggling to carry out less than 200,000 tests per day, while it had previously said that it's expecting to do 500,000 a day by the end of October. So, I mean, you had lots of stories about people in London being told that they'd have to go to Scotland to get a test done, which obviously isn't workable. So this whole using technology that doesn't exist to do very quick tests on everyone does seem a bit optimistic. But hey, maybe this will be the thing that is actually true.
But probably not. So therefore, our first stat was a positive stat. The record industry in the US continues to grow despite everything. Our second stat, I guess, is a bit of a pessimistic or certainly cynical stat. The big plan in the UK to get live music back is so ambitious and unrealistic, it isn't going to happen. But stat number three, I think, is basically another positive stat.
Well, it depends on your view of guitar music, I think, because stat number three is that guitar maker Fender saw users of its Fender Play Guitar Tuition app increase 420% over the first 3 months of lockdown. User numbers jumped from 150,000 to 930,000 between late March and late June after it announced that it was extending the app's free trial period to 3 months.
Yeah, so these stats about Fender's tuition app, they all came up in an interview with the guitar company's chief executive, Andy Mooney, with the New York Times, when basically he was presenting a very positive perspective of what is happening at Fender and saying that given that in recent years, there have been articles saying that nobody's interested in the guitar anymore. Children and teenagers, they don't want to learn to play guitar. Everyone's into electronic music. They're into hip-hop and grime. The guitar is dead. Guitar music is dead. Despite all of that, basically what he was saying was, we're selling more guitars than ever. We're selling more products than ever. People are signing up to our app. Now is a great time to be in the guitar making business. It's basically what Fender's boss was saying in this New York Times interview.
Now you might be thinking, yeah, sure, but all these customers that you've suddenly got who are signing up to your app and buying your guitars. I mean, he said in this interview that they were on track to have their highest sales year ever, which is quite something. But all these people picking up the guitar are most likely furloughed workers in their 40s and 50s, rather than the kids and the next generation of music makers. But no, he said, quite a lot of them actually are young adults and teenagers, many of them women and girls. They're skewing another demographic that is particularly commonly brought up when talking about guitar sales stats. And so the next generation of music makers are all going to be playing guitars, and there will be a good gender balance among them. We've got a lot of exciting or not exciting music ahead of us.
Depending on your perspective, most of the aging journalists who get excited about the vinyl revival will be getting excited about the resurgence of the guitar as an instrument, and therefore potentially the return of rock music to dominance in the wider scheme of things. Mooney said in this interview with the New York Times, "We've broken so many records this year selling guitars." He did concede that I think that COVID and people being stuck at home had helped. But as you say, keen to stress that it wasn't just middle-aged office workers who were stuck at home who were buying these guitars. He then said, "It will be the biggest year of sales volume in Fender history. We've had record days of double-digit growth, e-commerce sales and beginner gear sales. I never would have thought we would have been where we are today if you had asked me about it back in March." So there you go. A positive stat for fans of guitars and guitar playing.
Yeah, what it didn't say, though, was, I mean, obviously that app use growth was significant, but we don't know how many people actually used that app or will continue to use it long term, or even use the guitars they bought long term and become music makers of the future. I mean, I signed up for that app and I did not use it once. I got my weekly reminders to use it until it said, "You've got 48 hours left on your subscription." Oh, well, I haven't touched that, but I've been busy. Also, I'm already awesome at guitar, so I don't need it.
Well, you are famously A, lazy, and B, primarily a drummer. So that might have had the impact on that.
I mean, I haven't played drums either. I haven't done anything.
Well, you've recorded
I played bass once for about 2 minutes.
You've recorded some podcasts and written some nonsense about the music industry. You've not wasted lockdown by any means. Hey, stat number four.
Oh, yeah, our next stat. It's more of a number rather than a stat. I mean, if you want to go through this with a fine-tooth comb, we've already done something that wasn't quite a stat, but let's ignore that. Last week, Sony Music agreed to set aside $12.7 million to settle a class action lawsuit. This was the case brought against it over deductions made on foreign royalties by the estate of 1950s pop star Ricky Nelson. Although Sony denies any wrongdoing, as well as setting aside that cash to provide members of the class in the class action a royalty boost for past streams, the company is also committed to increase future royalties on foreign streams by 36%.
So this case filed by the estate of Ricky Nelson a couple of years back is all based on a common royalties gripe that artists have against record companies. It all relates to what happens if you sign to an American record company, but it's a big record company, in this case, a major record company that has divisions all over the world. So you are signed to a record company in the US, you get a royalty rate, which is a percentage royalty rate, but then your music is streamed in Australia. And the Australian division of the record company collects the money in Australia. It then takes a deduction, hands the money over to the US label, which then pays the artist a percentage of what it received from the Australian division, rather than the money that came in to start with. It's a very common gripe when deductions of these kinds are made, as money moves around major and big record companies. It kind of originates in the fact that in the olden days, and this is quite an old record contract that we're talking about here, there were two things. First of all, in those days, we were talking about the days of vinyl, and then, I suppose, subsequently CDs. And in the physical era, if you're an American label, but then you put out the record in Australia, There is quite a lot of tangible work involved in getting the disc out in Australia, and there might be some extra marketing involved. So maybe that justifies the Australian division taking a cut. Also, in the days when these record contracts were signed, there weren't really any global music companies. So actually what was probably happening was that the American record company was doing a deal with a totally separate Australian record company, allowing them to release the record in Australia, and therefore taking a cut. And what the Ricky Nelson estate said in their lawsuit was, if it's genuinely another third-party record company in the other country doing some work and taking a cut, then we get that. We're fine with that. But if it's just a Sony Music subsidiary, it's all Sony Music. Those foreign deductions shouldn't happen. And that is why we are suing, because we think we should be getting more money on streaming. I mean, I think with streaming, it's kind of fair enough, isn't it? At the end of the day, the American label can upload the music into Spotify and Apple. It's then available globally. I mean, unless the Australian people are doing some catalogue marketing, they're doing nothing. So in some ways, I can see the argument. So that was what the lawsuit was all about. As you say, Sony have denied any wrongdoing. They're saying you're wrong. Your interpretation of these old record contracts is wrong. But much to our annoyance, we'd rather not fight this out in court. We'd rather not spend years in the American courts spending loads of money on litigation. Hence why they got a mediator in and they reached this settlement.
Yes, you say they did get a mediator in because they did agree that it would be preferable to reach a settlement, although negotiations went on for a while and they could not reach any sort of agreement. So this mediator was brought in, which did result in the settlement now proposed to the court. That settlement still needs court approval, so it remains to be seen if that is granted, and if so, how many heritage artists then come forward to seek to benefit from it.
Although we should add that although Sony have claimed no wrongdoing, and although we had to get a mediator in order to get an agreement, the estate seem quite happy with the agreement and are saying that it will have a good tangible impact on the royalties that they earn from the Ricky Nelson catalogue, and of course, because it was a class action, any other artists signed to Sony with similar contracts from the same era, they should also see the benefit as well.
So that brings us to stat number 5, which is that Spotify has revealed that Belgium's Tomorrowland Festival is the event that people in Europe have most been pining for during this year's cancelled festival season, at least when it comes to playing associated playlists on Spotify.
Yes, these final stats could possibly be categorised under nonsense stats. But these are some figures that Spotify have provided us with. As we all know, because of COVID-19, most music festivals that were due to take place across Europe from March onwards haven't happened. They have been cancelled. So people who like going to festivals over the summer months in Europe have generally been disappointed, and they haven't. However, many of those festivals, although they couldn't happen in the real world, they have been doing stuff online. Quite what that means varies. Maybe they stream some stuff from the archives. Maybe they do some live streaming of new material. Some, like Tomorrowland, have been doing virtual events of various different kinds. But in addition to all of that, one thing we have seen in the festival space is, on the streaming services, lots of playlists popping up, some of them official playlists that the festivals have been creating and updating to try and keep people interested in what they do during lockdown. And in other cases, there are unofficial playlists where fans of the festivals, possibly because they're stuck at home and they're missing the festivals, have been setting up playlists linked to the festivals that they would like to go and see if only there was festivals to actually go to.
Yeah, so for Tomorrowland, according to Spotify, that meant a 1,231% increase in plays of related playlists. Glastonbury in the UK took the number 2 spot in Europe and, unsurprisingly, the number 1 spot in the UK. In fact, over Glastonbury weekend, there was a 1,430% increase in playlist listening.
However, the country where festival fans were playing festival playlists the most was Germany, streaming 99% more festival playlists there than in any other country, with the UK in second place in that regard. Which is interesting, I suppose. I mean, you could be cynical on all of this and say that the streaming market in Germany is somewhere behind the streaming market in UK, so therefore things are increasing faster there anyway, because more people are tuning into streaming for the first time, so therefore an uplift in listening of certain sorts of playlists, that might be more to do with that than anything festival-related or COVID-related. Who knows? But as we said, these are some nonsense stats for the end of the podcast, so I don't think we should think about it too much.
Yeah, speaking of which, I mean, it's probably worth mentioning that the data collected was from between the 1st of March this year to the 17th of August. That misses out the whole second half of August, where quite a lot of festivals take place. I mean, in the UK, the big one would be Reading and Leeds, which came 5th in the UK's most played charts. But if the stats had covered the weekend where it took place, you might have seen that come a lot higher up the list. So, I mean, that just adds to the argument that these are nonsense stats, I think.
But maybe they show that there is still a big appetite out there for music festivals, and the live industry, that is still in a very rocky position at the moment, can be optimistic about the fact that when Boris Johnson's plan comes together and we can all have full capacity events by November, and everyone else in the world copies the great United Kingdom, Great Britain with its solutions and its solution-driven government, then it'll all be fine. And yeah, happy days, and future set list statistic specials will be full of positive growth stats for everybody. I am sure that's true.
Sure. Yeah. Well, that is the end of this edition of Setlist. Do remember, if you haven't already, to really hit that subscribe button very hard. And also, while you're at it, rate and review the show, because that apparently helps. If you've got any questions or comments about anything we have discussed on this episode of the show, you can find the show notes for the show where I'll put links to all of the stories that we've discussed. You can find that either in your podcast player right now or at setlistpodcast.com. You could also email us, setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by Andy Malt and Chris Cook. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Setlist is an Unlimited production.
Every business has an ambition. PayPal Open is the platform designed to help you grow into yours. With business loans so you can expand and access to hundreds of millions of PayPal customers worldwide. And your customers can pay all the ways they want. With PayPal, Venmo, Pay Later, and all major cards. So you can focus on scaling up. When it's time to get growing, there's one platform for all business. PayPal Open. Grow today at paypalopen.com. Loan subject to approval in available locations.